from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio, this is a special statewide broadcast of the California Report. I'm Rachel Miro. In just a few moments, Governor Jerry Brown will deliver his third State of the State address at the state capitol in Sacramento. He'll deliver his remarks in the chambers of the State Assembly, and we expect he'll talk for 15, 20 minutes or so. After he's done, we'll have analysis of what the governor had to say. Like his predecessor, Arnold Schwarzenegger, Jerry Brown threatened state lawmakers he'd go to the voters if they didn't work with him to raise revenue. Unlike Schwarzenegger, Brown won at the polls. So today, he can boast a more balanced budget proposal than the state has seen in years. But it's going to take us more than one budget year to recuperate from one doozy of a financial hangover from the Great Recession. Among those waiting at the state capitol for the governor to arrive is Anthony York, who covers politics for the Los Angeles Times. So good to have you with us, Anthony.
Good to be with you.
Well, it looks like the introductory remarks have begun. People are being introduced. Tell us a little bit about what's going on today in the Assembly Hall.
Well, we have, the state's elected officials, legislators, dignitaries, constitutional officers. They're all waiting to hear the governor's vision for the year ahead. I think we can expect to hear a little bit about where we've been over the last couple of years and where this governor wants to take the state in the last half of his term and on into the future.
Are we expecting anything markedly different from the budget he's already unveiled?
No, I mean, I think thematically it's the same. I think this is really an opportunity for him to crystallize some of the things that were in his budget. You know, the budget was a lot of numbers. This will be really sort of a collecting some of those ideas, sort of looking at the last 2 years of his term, about how Democrats made tough cuts and with some voter approved taxes. Now California is on a more stable economic footing. And that will allow him to sort of put forward some of his plans for investing in the future, whether it be water, high-speed rail, some plans about the public universities. I think the sort of forward-looking things we can expect to hear a lot of today.
So this is really a vision statement.
It's a vision statement, and I think a little bit of a victory lap, too. You know, I think the governor has made it clear. We're just looking at prepared text here. His opening line talks about how California has once again confounded our critics. There's something about the national narrative. You know, California has been something of a national punchline for years about its deficits and its lack of governability. And I think the governor takes a certain pride in showing that that national narrative is maybe not completely accurate.
He has had a lot of fun in past State of the State addresses mocking what he calls dystopian journalists.
Right. Well, and the declinists that stretch beyond the ranks of just the journalists. So, I think this is a little bit of a thumb in the eye to his critics, but really that's incidental to the meat of the speech, I think.
Well, I should mention we have here in the studio with us Joe Simidian, Santa Clara County Supervisor for District 5, and a veteran of the California State Legislature for, I think, is it about 12 years?
These past 12 years were spent in Sacramento, both in the Senate and the Assembly.
So, Joe Simidian, tell us a little bit about what California governors hope to accomplish with a State of the State address.
Well, I think to some extent it depends on the year. If there's a particular crisis at hand, that may be the message of the year. I remember back in 2001, my first year in the state legislature, the energy crisis was upon us, and that was Governor Gray Davis's opportunity to make a call to action, if you will, for members. Certainly 2 years ago, in Governor Brown's first State of the State address, he used it as an opportunity to throw down the gauntlet with respect to the need to balance the budget. I remember he called for vision and discipline, talked about the importance of putting the matter to a vote of the people, tried to suggest that Democrats ought to own up to the fact that there needed to be budget reductions, but Republicans needed to own up to the fact that there needed to be some revenue increases and that they ought to let the public decide the kinds of trade-offs they wanted to make. So, the context, the headlines of the day have a lot to do with how I think the governor chooses to use his State of the State.
You know, we've seen in the last few weeks the governor talking about a lot of familiar topics that he has tried to bring up before the state legislature in the last few years, sometimes with success, sometimes not so much.
Well, I think, if you're a regular news junkie, if you're listening to KQED or reading your local newspaper, you've probably been able to discern over the years that rarely does big work get done in a single year. It can take year after year after year. So a governor is hoping to raise some of these issues perhaps for the first time, but make progress in a second, third, and fourth year of his administration. Last year, the governor raised in the budget process this whole new effort at something called a weighted-based student formula for public education here in California. And it really didn't go anywhere. It got a pretty chilly reception. I think part of that was the fact that it was part of the budget process rather than on a standalone basis. But he may very well have been thinking, look, I've got to toss this out, get the conversation started, and we'll come back next year in earnest. I would be very surprised if we don't hear a fair amount in today's speech about education funding. This is clearly an issue that the governor wants to tackle.
What do you think, Anthony York?
I would agree with that. I think, this is not just about, it's about restoring some of the budget cuts to education over the last couple of years, but also really changing the policy, changing the formulas by which our public schools are funded, having some, urging some changes at the universities as well. And so, it's not just going to be about funding, but really about reforming some of these programs to build a sustainable future and what the governor sees as a more equitable future for the state.
And I think that's the challenge, Rachel, that the governor has, is to make this a more readily understood conversation about student funding in California. You can see whole audiences with their eyes glazed over if you start talking about a weighted student formula.
It's not a great brand.
No, but if you say, are we looking at funding that is fair, adequate, and transparent?
It looks now like the governor is getting up to give his speech.
Let's see what he says.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Speaker, Mr. Senate Pro Tem, fellow constitutional officers, members of the judiciary, and all my friends gathered here this morning. The message this year is clear. California has once again confounded our critics. We've wrought in just 2 years a solid and enduring budget. And by God, we're going to preserve and keep it that way for years to come. Let's not applaud too much. This is one of my longest speech. We're not going to get out of here if we don't keep moving. Against those who take pleasure seeing of our demise, California did the impossible. You, the legislature, did it. You cast difficult votes to cut billions from the state budget. You curbed prison spending through an historic realignment, and you reformed and reduced the state's long-term pension liabilities. Then, the citizens of California, using their inherent political power under the Constitution, finished the task. They embraced the new taxes of Proposition 30 by a healthy margin of 55% to 44%. Members of the legislature, I salute you for your courage, for wholeheartedly throwing yourself into the cause. I salute the unions, their members, and their leaders. You showed what ordinary people can do when they're united and organized. I salute those leaders of California business and the individual citizens who proudly stood with us. I salute the teachers and the students and the parents and the college presidents, the whole school community. As the great jurist Oliver Wendell Holmes once said, when describing what stirs people to action, feeling begets feeling, and great feeling begets great feeling. You were alarmed. You stirred yourself to action, and victory was the outcome. That was 2012, and what a year. In fact, both 2011 and 2012 were remarkable. You did great things. Your one-third renewable energy mandate, the reformers' workers' compensation, the reorganization of state government, protecting our forests and strengthening our timber industry, reforming our welfare system, and launching the nation's first high-speed rail system. But of course, governing never ends. We have promises to keep, and the most important one is the way we made to the people, if Proposition 30 passed, that we would guard jealously the money temporarily made available. This means living within our means and not spending what we don't have. Fiscal discipline is not the enemy of our good intentions, but the basis for realizing them. It's cruel to lead people on by expanding good programs only to cut them back when the funding disappears. This isn't progress. It's not even progressive. It's an illusion. The stop and go, the boom and bust serves no one. We're not going back there. This budget is balanced, but great risks and uncertainties lie ahead. The federal government, the courts, or changes in the economy all could cost us billions and drive a hole in the budget. The ultimate costs of expanding our health care system under the Affordable Care Act are unknown. Ignoring such unknown unknowns would be folly. In fact, they're known unknowns, just as it would be to pay down our wall of debt. That's how we plunged into a decade of deficits. Recall the story of Genesis and Pharaoh's dream of seven cows, fat-fleshed and well-favored, which came out of the river, followed by seven other cows, lean-fleshed and ill-favored. Then the lean cows ate up the fat cows. The Pharaoh could not interpret his dream until Joseph explained it to him, that the seven fat cows were 7 years of great plenty, and the seven lean cows were 7 years of famine that would immediately follow. The Pharaoh took the advice of Joseph and stored up great quantities of grain during the years of plenty. When famine came, Egypt was ready. The people has given us 7 years of extra taxes. Let us follow the wisdom of Joseph, pay down our debts, and store up reserves against the leaner times that will surely follow. In the midst of the Great Depression, Franklin Roosevelt said, "There's a mysterious cycle in human events. To some generations, much is given. Of other generations, much is expected. This generation has a rendezvous with destiny. We, right here in California, have such a rendezvous with our own destiny. All around us, we see doubt and skepticism about our future and that of America's. But we have accomplished together, all the people in this room and what you'll accomplish coming up. Indeed, the whole history of California belies such pessimism. Remember how California began. In 1769, under King Charles III, orders were issued to Jose de Galvez, the Visitor General of Baja California, occupy and fortify San Diego and Monterey for God and the Crown of Spain. Gaspar Portola and a small band of brave men made their way slowly north along an uncharted path. Eventually, they reached Monterey, but they couldn't recognize the bay in the dense fog. With their supplies failing, they marched back to San Diego, forced to eat the flesh of emaciated pack mules just to stay alive. Undaunted, Portola sent for provisions from Baja California and promptly organized a second expedition. He retraced his steps northward along what was to become El Camino Real, the King's Highway. This time, Father Serra joined the expedition by sea. The rest is history, a spectacular history of bold pioneers meeting every failure with even greater success. The founding of the missions, secularized and sold off in little more than 50 years. The displacement and the devastation of the native people. The discovery of gold. The coming of the 49ers and adventurers from every continent. First by the thousands, and then by the hundreds of thousands. Then during the Civil War, under President Lincoln, the Transcontinental Railroad and land-grant colleges. Followed by the founding of the University of California. And oil production, movies, and aircraft industry. The longest suspension bridge in the world. Aerospace, the first freeways, grand water projects, Jet Propulsion Laboratory, Venture Capital, Silicon Valley, Hewlett-Packard, Apple, Qualcomm, Google, and countless others. existing and still just imagined. What is this but the most diverse, creative, and longest-standing mass migration in the history of the world? That's California, and we are our sons and daughters. This special destiny never ends. It slows, it falters, it goes off the track in ignorance and prejudice, but soon resumes again, more vibrant and more stunning in its boldness. The rest of the country looks to California, not for what's conventional, but for what's necessary, necessary to keep faith with our courageous forebears. What we've done together and what we must do in the coming years is big, but it pales in comparison to the indomitable courage of those who discovered and each decade thereafter built a more abundant California. As legislators, it's your duty and privilege to pass laws. But what we need to do for our future will require more than producing hundreds of new laws each year. Montaigne, the great French writer of the 16th century, in his essay on experience, wisely wrote, "There is little relation between our actions, which are in perpetual mutation, and fixed and immutable laws. The most desirable laws are those that are the rarest, simplest, and most general. And I even think that it would be better to have none at all than to have them in such numbers as we have. Constantly expanding the coercive power of government by adding each year so many minute prescriptions to our already detailed and turgid legal system overshadows other aspects of public service. Individual creativity and direct leadership must also play a part. We do this not by commanding thou shalt or thou shalt not through a new law, but by tapping into the persuasive power that can inspire and organize people. Lay the Ten Commandments next to the Education Code, and you'll see how far we've diverged in approach and content from that which forms the basis of our legal system. In the right order of things, education, the early fashioning of character and the formation of conscience, comes before legislation. Nothing is more determinative of our future than how we teach our children. If we fail at this, we will sow growing social chaos and inequality that no law can rectify. In California's public schools, there are 6 million students, 300,000 teachers, all subject to tens of thousands of laws and regulations. In addition to the teachers in the classroom, we have a principal in every school, a superintendent and a governing board for each school district. Then we have the state superintendent and the state board of education, which makes rules and approves endless waivers, often of laws which had just passed. Then there's the Congress, which passes laws like No Child Left Behind. And finally, the Federal Department of Education, whose rules, audits, and fines reach into every classroom in America, where 60 million students study, not six. Add to this fact that 3 million California school-aged children speak a language at home other than English, and more than 2 million live in poverty. And we have a funding system that is overly complex, bureaucratically driven, and deeply inequitable. That's the state of affairs today. The laws that are in fashion demand tightly constrained curricula and reams of accountability data. All the better if it requires quiz bits of information, regurgitated at regular intervals and stored in vast computers. Performance metrics, of course, are invoked like talismans. Distant authorities crack the whip, demanding quantitative measures and a stark single number to encapsulate the precise achievement level of every child. We seem to think that education is a thing, like a vaccine, that can be designed from afar and simply injected into our children. But as the Irish poet William Butler Yeats said, education is not the filling of a pail, but the lighting of a fire. This year, as you consider new education laws, I asked you to consider the principle of subsidiarity. Subsidiarity is the idea that a central authority should only perform those tasks which cannot be performed at a more immediate or local level. In other words, higher or more remote levels of government, like the state, should render assistance to local school districts, but always respect their primary jurisdiction and the dignity and the freedom of teachers and students. Subsidiarity is offended when distant authorities prescribe in minute detail what is taught, how it is taught, and how it is to be measured. I'd prefer to trust our teachers, who are in the classroom each day doing the real work, lighting fires in young minds. My 2013 budget lays out the case for cutting categorical programs and putting maximum authority and discretion back at the local level with school boards. I'm asking you to approve a brand new local control funding formula which distributes supplemental funds, not the basic funds, supplemental ones, over an extended period of time to school districts based on the real-world problems they face. This formula recognizes that a child in a family making $20,000 a year, or speaking a language different from English, or living in a foster home requires more help. Equal treatment for children in unequal situations is not justice. With respect to higher education, cost pressures are relentless, and many students can't get the classes that they need. 500,000 fewer students this year enrolled in the community colleges than in 2008. Graduation in 4 years is the exception, and transition from one segment to the other is difficult. The University of California, the Cal State system, and the community colleges are all working on this. The key here is thoughtful change, working with the faculty and the college presidents. But tuition increases are not the answer. I'm not going to let the students of California become the default financiers of our colleges and universities. California was the first in the nation to pass laws to implement President Obama's historic Affordable Care Act. Our health benefit exchange called Covered California will begin next year, providing insurance to nearly 1 million Californians. Over the rest of this decade, California will steadily reduce the number of the uninsured. Today, I'm calling for a special session to deal with those issues that must be decided quickly if California is to get the Affordable Care Act started by next January. The broader expansion of Medi-Cal that the Act calls for is incredibly complex. It'll take more time. Working out the right relationship with the counties will test our ingenuity and will not be achieved overnight. Given the costs involved, great prudence should guide every step of the way. California lost 1.3 million jobs in the Great Recession, but we're coming back at a faster pace than the national average. The new Office of Business and Economic Development, GoBiz, and thank you, John, it was your bill, one of the good bills, directly assisted more than 5,000 companies this past year. One of those companies was Samsung Semiconductor, headquartered in Korea. Working with the city of San Jose and Santa Clara County, GoBiz persuaded Samsung to locate their only research and development facility in the world right here in California. The new facility in San Jose will place up to 5,000 people in high-skill, high-wage jobs. We also leveled the field on internet sales taxes, paving the way for over 1,000 new jobs at new Amazon distribution centers in Patterson, San Bernardino, and now Tracy. This year, we should change both the Enterprise Zone program and the job hiring credit. They aren't working. We also need to rethink and streamline our regulatory procedures, particularly the California Environmental Quality Act. Our approach needs to be based more on consistent standards that provide greater certainty and cut needless delays. California's exports... That gives the Republicans something to clap at. California's exports are booming, and our place in the world economy's never been stronger. Our ties with the People's Republic of China are deep. From the Chinese immigrants crossing the Pacific in 1848 to hosting China's next president in Los Angeles last February. This year, we'll take another step to strengthen the ties between the world's second and ninth largest economies. In April, I'll lead a trade and investment mission to China with the help of the Bay Area Council and officially open California's new trade and investment office in Shanghai. Central to the life of our state is water, and one-sixth of that water flows through the San Joaquin Delta. Silicon Valley, the Livermore Valley, farmers on the east side of the San Joaquin between Fresno and Kern County, and farmers on the west side between Tracy and Los Banos, urban Southern California, and northern Contra Costa, all are critically dependent on the Delta for water. If, because of an earthquake, they used to call it a 200-year storm, but it might be a 100-year storm, last one was in the 1860s, or a sea level rise, that the Delta fails, the disaster would be comparable to Hurricane Katrina or Superstorm Sandy. Losses of at least $100 billion and 40,000 jobs. I'm going to do whatever I can to make sure that doesn't happen. My proposed plan is two tunnels, 30 miles long and 40 feet wide, designed to improve the ecology of the Delta with almost 100 square miles of habitat restoration. Yes, that's big, but so is the problem. The London Olympics lasted a short while. It cost $14 billion, about the same cost as this project. But this project will serve Californians for hundreds of years. When you think about California's future, no long-term liability presents as greater danger to our well-being as the buildup of carbon dioxide and other greenhouse gases in the atmosphere. According to the latest report from the World Bank, carbon dioxide emissions are the highest in 15 million years. At today's emissions rate, the planet could warm by more than 7 degrees Fahrenheit by the end of the century, an event unknown in human experience. Some of you are going to be around for that. I won't. California is extremely vulnerable because of our Mediterranean climate, long coastline, and reliance on snowpack from so much of our water supply. Tipping points can be reached before we even know we've passed them. This is a different kind of challenge than we ever faced. It requires acting now, even though the worst consequences are perhaps decades in the future. Again, California is leading the way. We're reducing emissions as required by AB 32, and we'll meet our goal of getting carbon emissions to 1990 levels by 2020. Key to our efforts... Key to our efforts is reducing electricity consumption through efficiency standards for buildings and appliances. Over the last three decades, these pioneer efforts have saved Californians $65 billion, and we're not through yet. $65 billion. That's what this legislature did over 30 years ago, and we're still taking profit from it. That's the future, and that's what gets things done. We're also meeting our renewable energy goals, more than 20% renewable energy this year. A few years ago, every utility executive said it couldn't be done, and we've already have. By 2020, we'll get at least a third of our electricity from the sun and the wind and other renewable sources, and probably more. In the years following World War II, California embarked on a vast program to build highways, bridges, and roads. Today, California's highways are asked to accommodate more vehicles than any other state in the nation. Most of the structures were constructed before we knew about climate change and the lethal effects of dirty air. We now expect more. I've directed our transportation agency to review thoroughly our current priorities and explore long-term funding options. Last year, you authorized another big project, high-speed rail. Yes, it's bold, but so is everything about California. Electrified trains are part of the future, China already has 5,000 miles of high-speed rail, and they intend to double that. Spain has 1,600 miles and is building more. More than a dozen other countries have their own successful high-speed rail systems. Even Morocco is building one. The first phase will get us from Madeira to Bakersfield. Then we'll take it through the Tehachapi Mountains to Palmdale, constructing 30 miles of tunnels and bridges. The first rail line through those mountains was built in 1874, and its top speed over the crest is still 24 miles an hour. Then we're going to build another 33 miles of tunnels and bridges before we get the train to its destination at Union Station in the heart of Los Angeles. We all know the story of the little engine that could. The big engines were asked to haul the freight train over the mountain. They said, can't do it. They asked another, can't do it. The little train said, I think I can. And so he pulled the engine pulled in front of the long line of freight cars and started puffing away. I think I can. I think I can. I think I can. I think I can. And over the mountain, the little engine went. We're going to get over that mountain. I have no doubt about it. It's taken great perseverance to get us this far. I signed the original high-speed rail authority in 1982, more than 30 years ago. In 2013, we finally break ground and start construction. This is my 11th year in the job, and I've never been more excited. 2 years ago, they were writing our obituary. Well, it didn't happen. California's back, its budget is balanced, and we're on the move. Let's get it done. Thank you.
You've been listening to California Governor Jerry Brown wrapping up another State of the State address, his third since taking office. You're listening to the State of the State address, a special broadcast from the California Report. Well, just to recap what we've heard from Governor Brown, California has once again confounded our critics, he began. We've heard a bit of a history lesson in the last few minutes, going back to the book of Genesis in the Bible. More recently, the governor praised state lawmakers, public employees, and citizens for making tough fiscal choices. The challenges we face in 2013 look a lot like the ones we faced last year and years before that. Education and health care programs stretching a dime to make a dollar. Governor Brown is not promising a lot more money, but he does want to reform what the state funds and how. Performance measures, Brown complained, are invoked like talismans. But of course, that's how we talk about public policy. So with that, we have here in studio Joe Simidian, Santa Clara County Supervisor and veteran of California state politics. Thank you so much for being here.
Really a fascinating speech, I thought, Rachel. And vintage Jerry Brown. You know, who else in the space of 20, 25 minutes would invoke not just the Book of Genesis, but Franklin Roosevelt, King Charles III, Gaspar Portola, Montaigne, President Lincoln, and the little engine that could? I mean, that's quite a journey. And I thought it was an effective speech, as Anthony York suggested at the outset, did not miss the opportunity to give the state a pat on the back and say, we've done it. But for me, I thought perhaps the most important line was the observation by the governor, fiscal discipline is not the enemy of good intentions, but the basis for realizing them. And he is trying with that two-thirds Democratic majority in both houses of the legislature to make the case that we do not serve the public well if we allow our expenditures to get out in front of our resources. And I thought that was a line that was designed very specifically for members of the legislature who were there in the chambers.
And as he pointed out during the speech, there is stuff in there for Republicans to applaud. We have with us on the phone Tom Del Baccaro, chair of the California Republican Party, who has been listening in from Charlotte, North Carolina. Tom Del Baccaro, are you there?
Yes, I am. Thanks for having me on.
Well, were you applauding from your corner?
Well, no, I don't applaud rhetoric. I applaud action. And, you know, it sounded good that he wants to decentralize education. That's a good idea. The question is whether something like that could pass the legislature. I'm guessing it won't. he sounded like he wanted to deregulate the economy, but the fact of the matter is that he's applauding the regulations of AB 32 that are strangling our economy. We have 2 million unemployed, able-bodied people in California. Unless there's real action as opposed to rhetoric, I don't see why this speech is particularly different. And really important when we talk about high-speed rail, by the way, he mentioned Spain. Spain just shut down miles of high-speed rail because people aren't using it and they couldn't afford to subsidize it anymore. High-speed rail threatens education funding. In 10 to 15 years, do Californians really believe that the federal government is going to give the money that is needed for high-speed rail? I'm guessing they're not. So the rhetoric was good, but it's action that matters, especially to the unemployed.
Well, let's move from rhetoric to action and talk about what the governor would need to do to make a lot of these ideas reality as we talk about the budget in the next 6 months. Joe, as you mentioned, a lot of Democrats on the floor. We've got a supermajority of Democrats in both houses, many of them keen to restore funding to a lot of programs treasured by both liberals and conservatives alike, education, for one. How does the governor go about rallying those folks to a fiscally prudent approach to reform?
Well, important to remember that the governor has both the veto power with respect to any piece of legislation that lands on his desk, and also what's known as the blue pencil or a line item veto, an item by item veto when it comes time to take a look at the budget. So the governor is in a very strong position. From time to time, there's a suggestion that a veto will be overridden by a two-thirds majority of the legislature. Hasn't happened since the last Brown administration more than 30 years ago. So I think, you know, it's good to be the governor. You get the last word as a legislator who's had bills vetoed over the years and been disappointed by gubernatorial vetoes. I know that. That being said, I think the challenge for the governor will be trying to find a way to pull Democrats and Republicans together on some of these issues. Remember, that was originally the governor's plan for the budget challenge. He came into office, I think perhaps a bit unduly optimistically, said, I'm going to find a handful of Republicans who will vote with Democrats to put these tax measures on the ballot. Took a shot at getting that done in the first 3 months of 2011 for what would have been a June election. Couldn't round up those Republicans. Tried again. And was shooting for a June measure on the ballot, or excuse me, a June vote by Democrats and Republicans to put something on the ballot in November of 2011, again came up short. Ultimately, and to Tom's point, you know, I give him credit, laser-like focus on balancing this budget, went ahead and put something on the ballot in 2012, campaigned for it as if his life depended on it, and was ultimately successful in getting a margin that I don't think anyone expected. I think we are at a place now where the governor has delivered, and the question now in the coming year will be, can he build on that, cobble together a coalition of Democrats and Republicans who want to move together, move forward in a way that we haven't seen, frankly, that much either in Sacramento or in Washington, D.C.
Tom Del Baccaro, you're listening to this. Can you share with us any change in game plan for California Republicans, in particular in Sacramento? November was a tough election for the GOP.
It was more than a tough election. The public employee union spent over $100 million, boasted they hired 40,000 people, and had a victory to show for it. This is a discussion of reality over rhetoric. I mean, he touts deregulation at the same time that he talks about the benefits of the largest regulatory scheme in human history, which is going to be AB 32. So it's sort of a mixed bag. I mean, it's great to listen to Jerry Brown talk about the need to decentralize education. What Republicans need to do is assist the governor on issues like decentralization and make sure we're returning choices back to school districts. And what they need to do is the same thing, frankly, the national Republicans need to do, is put up bills that truly show that they are saving Californians or the nation's money by reforming programs, and then dare the Democrats to turn them down. So Republicans need to do those two things, support the governor where he's truly reforming, put up their own reform bills. And importantly, going forward for Republicans in California, they need to go back to the districts and connect with more voters. They are not speaking to enough voters. I have railed against this with them for a decade now. And as the end of my chairmanship comes, I'm going to say it again to them. You have to develop relationships outside of Sacramento if you want to have more influence inside Sacramento.
Outside of Sacramento, and some would say outside of the districts that Republicans represent. And my question for you would be, we've seen a lot of state Republican lawmakers, heeding the call that they hear from constituents back home in their home districts. But what can Republicans do to put forth a statewide program, if you will, that either competes with the governor or complements the governor's program?
It's the same thing that I wrote in my Forbes article about Republicans need to stop whining and seize the agenda. What they need to do is put up reform bills. They need to, in California's case, a little bit more difficult. But once they put up those reform bills, then they need to go around the state and drum up support and put people on notice that these are the kind of things that they are doing. Nationally, they need to do the same thing. They need to actually put up reform bills and give it to Harry Reid and say, this is what we stand for. And then they need to go to the districts all across the country and in California and say, this is the savings we're looking for to help out. They need to have that laser focus, as the supervisor just mentioned, and show people that they have alternatives. This isn't about labels. I don't care if they're conservative, moderate, liberal, whatever they call themselves. They better provide solutions in the form of bills that say, here's how we can save taxpayer money and make things better.
And with that, we've been wrangling some state lawmakers there on the floor of the Assembly Hall. Assemblymember Joan Buchanan joins us from District 16, Chairwoman of the Assembly Education Committee. Thank you so much for talking with us.
Happy to be here.
Well, we're talking about reform. We're talking about fiscal restraint. What did you hear in the governor's speech, particularly about education?
Well, what was really heartwarming to me is the fact that the governor's making education a priority. And I applaud the governor and the people of California for passing Proposition 30 and making it clear that the people in California value education. You know, I share the governor's goals of wanting to simplify the system. I spent 18 years on the school board and know firsthand how complex our system is. I agree with the governor entirely that children who are born in poverty, English language learners, and those in foster care require more support than other students. But ultimately, I think we also have to remember that California has now fallen from 47th to 49th in the nation in per pupil spending. And whatever we do in the budget to redistribute the money, we're still 49th in per pupil spending. And, you know, districts all over the state, whether you're LA Unified, which has a much higher level of funding than Fresno Unified, despite the fact that they're both urban districts with very similar demographics, or in suburban districts where I was on the board, Santa Ramon Valley, we're right next door to Dublin that has a much higher revenue limit. You know, we have to understand that all these districts have been getting 77 cents on the dollar, that they've had to make cuts and difficult decisions, and we need to have a formula that takes us from the convoluted system we have now to where we want to be. That's very thoughtful. You know, we need to be sure that we allow districts, all of them in the state of California, to honor their contractual obligations and be able to pay their bills.
Joe Simidian, you've spent some time thinking about K through 12.
Well, I think Assemblymember Buchanan's characterization of the funding system as convoluted is giving it all the breaks. I often refer to our system of school finance here in California as the Winchester Mystery House of public funding. It is not a rational structure. It is not a structure anyone would have designed from scratch. And yet we keep adding to it year after year. It becomes more and more dysfunctional. But it will be a Herculean task for the governor to bring the legislature along in reforming that system. I started to say before the governor's remarks, no one would argue that the current system is fair or adequate or transparent. But whenever you reform the system, there will be winners and there will be losers. Now, I think the governor has a step up. Now that the tax measures have passed, it will be easier to generate more winners going forward. But the bottom line is you've got 1,000 school districts across the state representing these 6 million kids and their parents, and every one of those is going to say, what's in it for us? there will be winners, there will be losers, and that's where the battle will be joined by the local folks with respect to Sacramento's proposals.
On the face of it, it seems like having a discussion about how to rejigger school funding in the midst of a budget negotiation is insane, or is that the only way to do it?
No, and this was the surprise for me last year. In my last year in the Senate, I served on the Budget Committee. I served on the Senate Education Committee. The governor and his folks tried to do this reform, as they characterized it, through the budget process rather than find an author, a legislator who would introduce a bill and have the kind of thorough policy debate in committee after painful committee that I think a measure of this import really requires. My hope is that this year they'll take that approach, that they'll find an author, they'll carry the effort forward. I know it seems like a process issue, but if you're going to get everybody at the table and get to yes on this one, you really need that kind of process. This isn't something you can do quick and dirty in the last couple of weeks of the budget process.
Joan Buchanan, have you received a call from the Brown administration suggesting you could be that person?
Well, I don't know if I'll be that person, especially since it's coming before my committee. But I think both the Speaker and the President pro tem of the Senate have made it clear that this will go through policy committee. When you're talking about changing how you fund schools for decades to come, you know, we need to have a thoughtful process. We need to know how it's going to affect all of our schools and all of our students, and it needs to be based on data and not just ideals.
Well, thank you so much, Assemblymember, for talking with us today. You are listening to the State of the State Address Follow-Up, a special broadcast from the California Report and KQED Radio. We have here in studio Joe Simidian, now a Santa Clara County Supervisor, but somebody who has worked in Sacramento for about a dozen years, and you beamed with pride at a certain point in the discussion when you heard one of your bills
referenced. Well, I appreciated the shout-out on renewable energy. The governor touted our success at getting to 20% by 2020 and to get to the 33%, by 2020, having already gotten to 20% by 2010. And again, Rachel, to your point about how governors use these state of the state addresses, I remember very well in 2011, the governor gave a shout out to the issue of renewable energy. That was my clue that he might be receptive to signing the legislation I'd been working on at that point for more than 4 years. And as we talked about earlier, many of these ambitious goals that the governor has articulated will not be realized in a year or two or even three. But he lays them out now, exhorts the legislature to get on the job, and some of them will come to fruition this year. Others, it'll be years and years. But the renewable energy was another opportunity for the governor to give California a pat on the back and say, hey, we're getting it done, and in spite of the skeptics who thought we couldn't.
And do you think it'll actually happen by 2020?
I do. And it was interesting to me. The governor went off script a little. We're sitting here in the studio with a copy of the prepared remarks. He went off script a little to sort of give a jab to folks in the industry who said it couldn't be done. And he pointed out that in spite of the fact that they said it couldn't be done, it has been done and it is being done as we go forward. And, you know, for some folks in that chamber, this is an environmental issue in terms of climate change and air quality. For some, it's a jobs issue. I remember many of my Republican colleagues voted for my renewable energy efforts because they saw jobs in their districts. For some, it's a matter of national security in terms of energy independence. And I think some just understand that it's sound energy policy, so we don't have a repeat of the crisis we had back in 2001. All of these are the kinds of arguments that will play out on the governor's other ambitious proposals this year. And as I said earlier, he'll have to cobble together this coalition by making one set of persuasive arguments to one group and another compatible but different set of arguments to another.
Well, there are so many different issues the governor raised in his State of the State address, and it's hard to argue that none is more important than health care access. We have with us on the line Anthony Wright, Executive Director of Health Access, a consumer advocacy group working for quality, affordable health care for Californians. Mr. Wright, thank you for talking with us today.
Happy to be here.
Well, you know, unlike the field of education, where the governor is offering some more dollars to do what he wants done, it's not necessarily the case for healthcare programs. They have really been gutted in recent years.
Yes, we've seen $15 billion in cuts in the last several years in health and human services. And while we're appreciative that there are no new cuts in the governor's proposed budget, there really aren't restorations, and the governor made clear that that was not his intention. The good news is that at least on the health care side, there are a lot more resources coming in through the Affordable Care Act, and the governor did make news today by calling a special session on to do the final pieces of implementation of the Affordable Care Act, which will dramatically expand coverage and bring in billions of dollars into our health care system and economy.
Well, you know, up until now, California has been preparing and even beginning to roll out the Affordable Care Act at the county level. They've sort of been able to take the lead in terms of deciding how and where to spend money or not spend money. What is your sense going forward? Is this likely to be something where the state of California says, okay, thank you very much, we're going to take it from here? Or will that mantra of local control hold true for the Affordable Care Act as well?
I think that there are certain requirements under the Affordable Care Act in terms of how we expand coverage. The federal government is providing a significant share, if not all of the cost of doing the expansion. All of the new subsidies that will be available in this new exchange, now called Cover California, will be 100% federally financed. The Medicaid expansion will be 100% federally financed for the first 3 years, and even in the out years will be a 9-to-1 match. So there is the state has some important work to do in this year to get ready. We start enrollment in October 2013, and so we really need a statewide effort to really meet that deadline, meet that goal, so that Californians can maximize the benefit and take advantage of the new options and benefits under the law.
It's coming right up. Well, thank you so much, Anthony Wright, for talking with us about health care, at least touching on it. We've got now Assemblymember Jeff Gorell, representing Assembly District 44, Vice Chair of the Assembly Budget Committee. You heard Governor Brown mention what a lot of people in Sacramento are now calling the wall of debt. Do you see the governor making a serious effort to address California's obligations?
Well, that's a good question. He didn't mention much about the wall of debt today because he's only started to chip away at it in his most recent budget proposal. I think generally Republicans would have liked to see more in the budget directed toward paying down the structural debt of the budget as well as long-term liabilities. And it's not in there. It's one of the points of contention between where the governor's budget proposal is and where I am as a legislator, where my caucus is generally. But it's, you know, something we want to work on with him. And, you know, the fact that that his budget does have some portions of it that are realistic presumptions, and then he also focuses on directing monies toward education. I think those are some of the positive areas of the budget. But again, it's just a proposal at this time, and it's a 6 month long dance, and we're hoping to by the conclusion of this budget process to have a little more input into it, and including more monies directed toward chipping away at the wall of debt.
Joe Smidian?
I have to sit here and smile as somebody who's worked with my Republican colleagues over the last 12 years. You do wonder if the party will ever take yes for an answer. You've got a Democratic governor who has said, we have to live within our means and spend less. We have to pay down the wall of debt. We have to decentralize public education and return to local control. And he wants to loosen, and let's just say it out loud, weaken the environmental protections provided by the California Environmental Quality Act. But legislative Republicans should be giving this guy a big group hug. They should be smothering him with adulation in order to lock him in to some of these proposals. I doubt that my Republican friends are going to look to me for guidance on how they proceed during the course of the coming year. But I just, as I say, you know, at some point, take yes for an answer. This is there's a lot here to agree with and to partner on if the Republican Party will step up.
Will Assemblymember Gorell, do you have your arms outstretched for a hug?
I do believe that the governor will find more allies in the Republican caucus for most of the portions of his budget than he will in his own caucus in the Democrats, because there are a lot of things to like in his budget proposal, and we're working behind the scenes and out throughout California to support those portions of it, and he is to be commended for that, and for not spending money that we don't have, and for not proposing to raise taxes on a struggling economy beyond what we've already done. And so, yeah, absolutely, we're out there singing the praises of those portions of the budget. But you mentioned the wall of debt, and that is one thing that we would have liked to work on a governor with, a little bit more to have a long-term plan to chip away at that debt. His seven-year forecast does contemplate more money being moved in the direction of the debt, and I think that's a good thing. And we're going to be there to try to work on that with him over the next number of years. But it would have been nice out of the gate to try to address a little more this first time around. It's not necessarily an indictment of the budget or his vision. It's just something that we would like to work on with him over the next 6 months.
Well, Assemblymember, thank you so much. We turn now to Dean Vogel, president of the California Teachers Association. Dean Vogel, you heard the governor thank unions ahead of the citizens of California. Do you feel that you've got a real partner with Governor Jerry Brown?
Absolutely. Governor Brown was really clear with California this morning. Looked us all right in the eye and told us the truth, that if we really want to bring California back to glory, we do it together. And we do it by, standing shoulder to shoulder. And I think, it's not coincidental that he thanked the unions. In doing that, basically what he said was he thanked communities. He thanked people for paying attention. And, we're on the right path. And he thanked teachers. He basically said that, we've got to trust teachers to know what they're doing and get the work done. And that's gratifying.
Are you at all worried that this next year is going to bring more conversation about California's pension liabilities, about further cuts? Or do you think that the recovering economy indicates that might be taken off the table?
The pension liability conversation is going to continue, and we're hopeful that folks are going to come to the table with an open mind and understand that so much of the trauma around it is born out of the downward spiral of the economy that we were experiencing, and now that things are on the upswing. That's going to be a conversation that we're all going to be in, and we're looking forward to joining hands with all interested parties and finding practical, reasonable solutions.
Well, thank you so much, Dean Vogel, president of the California Teachers Association. Well, Joe Simonian, we've heard, it's a real smorgasbord of issues that the governor brought up. What do you think is the number one issue going forward in these next couple of months?
I think the governor is going to continue to push and push hard to make sure that California lives within its means. He clearly sees that as the key to success in every one of these endeavors. I think his view, as he has articulated it this morning and as he's shared it in the past, is if our house isn't in order financially, then the rest of the work just can't get done. I remember a few months back, Lieutenant Governor Gavin Newsom kind of dinged the governor for lack of a vision and for focusing exclusively on fiscal stability. I don't think the governor would apologize for that. He'd say that's exactly where he wants to be.
Well, thank you so much, Joe Simonian, and all of our guests and all of our listeners for joining us today. You've been listening to a special broadcast of the California Report, a production of KQED Public Radio. Thanks again to all of our guests this morning. Thanks also to the California Senate and Assembly Radio Services for technical help today. Our director is Nina Thorson. The engineer is Paul Ancour. I'm Rachel Miro. Thank you so much for listening. You're listening to the California Report.
Funds for the California Report are provided by the James Irvine Foundation. With nomination information about the 2014 James Irvine Foundation Leadership Awards, available at www.irvine.org. And the members of KQED Public Radio.